Turn with me to Job 28. Job 28. If you're using the blue ESV Bibles in the seat backs, you can find that on page 435. Job 28. The title of our sermon this morning is Where is Wisdom? And the key words for our worshipers in training are search, worth, and understanding. I have always been slightly fascinated by the weather, particularly stormy weather. During my junior year of college, my roommates and I became fascinated with John DeBont's 1996 summer blockbuster Twister, starring the late Bill Paxton. We watched it religiously, perhaps more than we did our homework. I don't really know why. I think it was something about Paxton's rough and tumble, one with nature portrayal of Bill, the extreme Harding. I think that's what drew us in, besides all the really cool tornadoes. The character, Bill Harding, was brave and courageous, though definitely very arrogant. But his courage, I think, inspired a group of young Bible college students to want to chase storms, which we did, in fact, one night in May of 2011. Thankfully, no one was hurt. The story of this movie, Twister, revolves around Bill, who reconnects with his former team of storm chasers, and they're trying to use a machine that Bill had designed that would provide them with scientific readings from the inside of a tornado. And this was, among other things, to help them develop an advanced warning system that would give people more time to get to safety when a tornado would develop in their area. The movie came out in 1996, so spoiler alert. Bill and his team are successful in the end, and everyone lives happily ever after, they lead us to believe. But here's the thing. While it's true that many advancements have been made in meteorology over the years, as depicted in this movie, we're still deeply perplexed by the weather. Perhaps just as perplexed as ever. This movie is a fictional story, but it depicts well man's interest in understanding the world around him, and yet ultimately leaves us with the complete inability to understand something that seems as basic as weather patterns. Think about real life for a moment. How many times have we checked the radar at, say, 7 a.m. and concluded on the basis of the information given to us by our trusty weatherman that it would indeed not be necessary to have rain boots or even an umbrella that day, only to be sorely, sorely disappointed in our life decisions by mid-afternoon? The truth is, man, for all the wonderful technological advancements that have been made throughout our history, man is still woefully ignorant of how the world actually works. And a display of this ignorance only begins with the rain and the wind. We haven't even begun to explore how little we know about the supernatural world or the moral aspects of the world. So we've come to the midway point through our excursion through the book of Job in these five sermons, and we're seeking an answer to this question of why. Why is the world the way that it is? In particular, why do we suffer in the way that we do? We saw in the opening two chapters that God is infinitely intimately involved in the world, and yet there's a distance between him and the evil that's perpetrated in the world. See, while God indeed is sovereign over Job's sufferings, he's not the one immediately attacking Job. Satan is. And this interplay between the sovereignty of God and the activity of Satan is this major theme that we see carried throughout the book in an answer to this question, why? And crucial to the question of why is a concern about Job's integrity. Will he, after all his suffering, will he curse God and die? Is the holiness of Job with which we are presented in chapter 1 just a mirage? Is it just an obvious response to the unbelievably rich and blessed life that God had given to him? What would he do if it all gets taken away? Will suffering serve to expose him as the fraud that he is? Or will he indeed hold fast to his integrity? While Job does curse the day of his own birth and by implication all of creation, and in fact he does not actually curse God. He's often tempted to see God as his adversary rather than his advocate. And he does seem to think at times that he could run the world better than God does. But as we saw last week in chapter 19, Job, even in his darkest moments, holds fast to his integrity. And he holds fast to his hope in God, believing that God will, in fact, vindicate him in the end. And while God makes clear at the end of the book in chapters 38 through 41 that there is much that Job does not understand, Job does have a genuine, if only partial, understanding of the realities behind his circumstances. And he knew that in spite of whatever sense he had, that God was his tormentor, it was God in the end to whom he must turn for deliverance. We see this tension follow from his profession of faith in chapter 19 that we looked at last week. Immediately following Job's famous words regarding his living Redeemer, he plunges back into darkness in chapter 20 and following. And the debates continue with his friends, but they get interrupted. And they begin to sort of come to a conclusion in chapters 26 through 31, where Job makes his final speech, where in the end he makes his speech with a self-justifying appeal for vindication. And his friends ultimately run out of words. They run out of things to say. And in the middle of this speech of Job's from 26 to 31, we find chapter 28, this hymn to wisdom. And it seems out of place. It's not addressed to anyone in particular. It doesn't protest Job's innocence. It doesn't really even seem to be at least a direct reply to anything that has been said so far. It's calm and measured, unlike the frenetic ramblings of the debates that have been raging since chapter 4. So what is chapter 28 doing here? What is the function of this chapter? Well, in many ways, it is the hinge on which the whole book of Job turns. We just said it's not a direct reply to anything that the friends have said so far, but it does allude to much that has come before in the preceding chapters, even if only subtly. And especially with its concluding verse, it highlights the necessity of the final chapters of the book, where God shows up to provide the revelation that was needed, since Job and his friends prove insufficient to uncover the mysteries of the universe. You see, at the heart of the book of Job is the question of the relationship between God, creation, providence, and evil. How did God make the world? How does God run the world? Not just the natural world, but the moral world. How does evil and therefore suffering fit into this very good world that God made? And the question behind all of these is this: where is wisdom? See, Job's friends understand that God runs the world, but they completely miss how it is that he does so. They see the world in pure mechanical terms. God is the great karmic genie. You do good things for God, you get good things. You do bad things toward God, you get bad things. God punishes the wicked here and now. He rewards the righteous here and now. Simple as that. Their concept of God and his providence allow for no fuller explanation. As we will see more clearly in chapters 38 through 41, and as is hinted at throughout these dialogues, this is a woefully inadequate view of the world. If I were to summarize chapter 28 in a sentence, it would be this: The wisdom behind the world is impossible to find, infinitely valuable, and belongs to God alone. The wisdom of the world is impossible to find, infinitely valuable, and it belongs to God alone. And it serves, this chapter serves to prepare us for God's answer in chapters 38 to 41, his answer, sort of as it were, to our questions. And they all stem from this central question, where is wisdom to be found? And I want to look at Job 28 with you this morning, see if we can find out. Job 28 divides fairly neatly into three sections. First, in verses 1 to 11, we see Job praise human ingenuity in the search for costly objects. Verses 12 to 22, we see the immeasurable worth of wisdom, and yet its complete inaccessibility to man. And in verses 23 to 28, we find the only one who knows where wisdom is to be found. So would you look with me then in the first 11 verses where we see man's ingenuity praised in a search for things of value. And I'll read those verses now. Job says, "Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out to the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air, far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. That path no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud beast have not trodden it. The lion has not passed over it. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams so that they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings out to light." So Job begins this song, and he says, surely there is a place for silver and gold. We know where to find and obtain iron and copper. Through danger, darkness, and desolation, man searches for precious metals, going down into the earth, far away from any inhabitable land. The earth above the miner produces food, but the search for silver and gold takes us to the underworld. It takes us to the place where fire is, ready to consume the careless searcher. And yet, surely, he says, we know where these things can be found. Difficult as it may be to reach them, we can find them. Job highlights the praiseworthiness of man's mining abilities in two ways in verses 7 to 11. First, he contrasts man's work with the unparalleled abilities of the falcon and the lion. He says the falcon, with its impeccable sight, cannot see down into the mine. The lion, even in all his strength, is unable to trod the path. But man has uncovered the place of these highly sought after commodities. Man's abilities, in other words, are nearly limitless in his search for things of worth and value. And if that doesn't make the point well enough, the second way he describes man's abilities here, in verses 9 to 11, he compares them with God's. He says that in our search for treasure, we overturn mountains and stop up rivers. But in Job 9:5, we're told that God is the one who overturns mountains. And we'll see in verse 25 that it is God's prerogative to apportion the waters. Man, we see again, though, is nearly unstoppable in his search for things of worth and value. Man is so good at this work that the falcon and lion, two of our greatest symbols of skill and speed and strength in the animal kingdom, they are not worthy to be compared to man. We must instead use theomorphic language to describe man's abilities. Man is like God in his ability to find valuable items. But before we consider the limits of man's skill, I want to ask a question here. Why does Job invite us into this search? Why does he seemingly out of nowhere spend 11 verses praising the seemingly limitless abilities of man's mining expeditions in search of costly objects? Well, in short, it's to set us up for what comes next. In these verses, we are invited, we're asked to consider the natural world and to marvel at the ingenuity of man to conquer it. And there are two themes that run through these 11 verses concerning man's mining expeditions. One, the search is costly. And two, the reward is extremely valuable. In verses 3 to 6, we see that man fights against darkness, desolation, and danger for the reward of obtaining things like silver, gold, iron, and copper. He weighs the cost of this work, and he considers it worth it. But why mining? Why is mining the example that Job gives? Well, I think it's because at least at one level, mining here acts as a mirror, a reflection of Job's experience and his own suffering. Job, like the miner, is searching for something. And as we'll see in a moment, his search is also very costly and the reward extremely valuable. Job, like the miner, spends his time alone in darkness with dangers lurking all around. And so chapter 28 serves as a pause of sorts in the tense back and forth argument that he's having with his friends. And it gives Job, and it gives us a moment for reflection. Job, back in chapter 3, had asked the question, why? Why have I been allowed to live simply to suffer like this? Or to put it another way, he asked, is God running the world well? So this opening depiction of mining expeditions illustrates for us the greater expedition that is at the heart of this book. And Job has come to an astonishing conclusion. He says, even with all of man's ingenuity in the search for costly objects, there is one object of worth that completely evades his grasp. Wisdom. Job asks in verse 12, but where is wisdom to be found? We know where to find gold and silver, but according to Job, we can search the world over and never find wisdom. This leads us then to our second consideration this morning, and that is the worth and yet utter inaccessibility of wisdom. See, this is in verses 12 to 22, and I'll read those. Now, he says, but where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and Death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. So Job and his friends could talk on and on and on for all eternity, but they would never, on their own, find the way to wisdom. They would never uncover the secrets of the universe that they sought so desperately, or rather, that Job sought so desperately that his friends thought they already knew. But Job tells us here, but if they could find wisdom, it would all be worth it. And yet they can't. He begins with this question, this transitional question to move from verses 1 to 11 into 12 through 22. And he asks, where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? He says, there's a place for gold, but is there a place for understanding? Perhaps there is, but man can't find it. It's not in the land of the living, nor can it be found in the deeps and depths of the sea. He says, part of the reason that man cannot find wisdom is that he doesn't know its worth. He knows the glory of gold, but he doesn't know the worth of wisdom. And this is the thrust of verses 15 to 19. He says, neither gold, nor silver, nor onyx, nor sapphire, nor glass, nor jewels, nor coral, nor crystal, nor pearls, nor topaz can be traded for wisdom. He says, if you had all the wealth in the world, all the riches that this life has to offer, you wouldn't be any closer to obtaining wisdom with your treasure than if you were the poorest beggar on the planet. Job is making this point. He says, if searching for anything is to be worth it, if any search is worth having, it is this search. It is the search for wisdom. And yet, this all-important search is doomed to fail. I think if you were to read through the book of Job, verse by verse, with this question in mind, as you go, and your heart just might skip a beat when you get to Job 28:12. Where can wisdom be found? He's about to tell us. You'd think, finally, an answer to our question. Finally, we have arrived at a satisfying explanation for why the world is the way that it is. And yet our hope plummets as we are left back on the ash heap of frustration with Job. For the answer that Job arrives at in this chapter is a very sobering one. He says, wisdom cannot be found among the living, in verse 13. Nor can it be found among the dead, in verse 22. Wisdom cannot be found in the deep oceans below, verse 14, nor in the vast skies above, verse 21. And to top it all off, he says, even if someone managed to find it, you couldn't buy it for all the treasure in the world. Verse 22 here is curious. Abaddon and death, verse 22, are not just references to death in general, or even perhaps to the place of the dead. Abaddon, according to Revelation 9:11, is the angel of the bottomless pit. Death and Abaddon then are the very guardians of the most desperate extremities of the cosmos, as one commentator put it. And Job says that they have only heard a rumor about wisdom. They can't even tell Job where it is. It says, search high and low, even to the supernatural realm, and you can't find wisdom. It is that elusive. Well, this brings us to our third heading this morning, where we find, thanks be to God, the only one who knows where wisdom is to be found. See this in verses 23 to 28. He says, God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens when he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder. Then he saw it and declared it and established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding. Job has asked twice now, where is wisdom to be found? Who is the one who is wise? Who is sufficient to make the world? Who is sufficient to run the world? Certainly not man. And in his search, Job discovers neither is it the birds of the air, nor the beasts of the field, not even the supernatural powers of death and destruction know the deep mysteries of the universe. But there is one who does. Job sings in verse 23, he says, God understands the way to wisdom. And notice here, we're not told here where wisdom is, but we are told to whom we must look. God knows the way to wisdom, and he knows its place. Gold has a place that man can find through, admittedly, dangerous, difficult, and desolate work. But wisdom has a place that only God can find. There are places that man, even with all his skill and insight, simply cannot go. And it is among them that wisdom must hide. But there is nothing hidden from the eyes of God. The eyes of the living and the birds of the air fail to see it, but not the eyes of God. God can find wisdom, we read in verses 24 to 27, because it was by wisdom that he created the universe. Here we're given a wonderful foreshadowing of what is to come in Job when Yahweh appears at the end and answers Job. Here Job turns to the most inexplicable forces of the world to demonstrate God's claim to wisdom. He says, God gives the wind its weight, the waters their measure. He tells the rain when to fall and the lightning where to go. And when he made the world, we're told in verse 27, he saw, declared, established, and searched out, and ultimately brought wisdom under his control. The blueprint for the universe is wisdom, and God alone can read it. And so ends the song. Verse 28 is not a part of Job's song. The first 27 verses of the verse are poetry. 28 is prose. And so it's a word of reflection. And so he's not singing this. This is a statement of reflection on what's come before. And it's the first time since chapter 2 that God speaks. And he answers this question. He says, do you want to know, Job, where wisdom is? Do you want to know why this has happened to you? Do you want to know if I'm running the world well? God says, that's for me to know. But you can trust me. Fear God, turn away from evil. That is the beginning of wisdom. He says, this isn't going to answer all of your questions, Job, but it will be sufficient for you. Fear God and turn away from evil. And so where is wisdom? Who is the one who is wise? Why does evil exist? Why do we suffer? These questions have answers. But the truth is, we're not really able to grasp those answers, even if they were given. Certainly not here and now. Not in full. So it might seem that the quest for wisdom, our quest for answers to life's most important and fundamental questions, seems like it ends here at Job 28:28. But if we actually read the verse, we see that in fact it's the opposite. The quest begins here. If we will fear God and turn away from evil, there and only there may we find the beginning to our answer. And Lord willing, as we'll consider a bit more next week, chapters 29 through 37 prove that theology alone cannot answer the question. You see, Job beautifully heralds the truth of the universe here in Job 28. God made it, God runs it. But then he launches into four chapters of self-righteous justification. You know, we learn profound things from Job. On the one hand, as we saw last week, we see even in our darkest moments, we can hope in God. But Job also teaches us, on the other hand, that sometimes, even in our most profound insights, we are plagued with fallenness and finitude. And after Job's self-justifying tirade in chapters 29 to 31, a new voice enters in chapters 32 to 37, and he serves as an arbiter of sorts between God and his adversary. Yet like Job's friends, he also proves inadequate. For all the bad and good theology that we see displayed in the conversations in this book, in the end, God himself must appear. And that's what chapter 28 anticipates. That's what this hymn to wisdom looks forward to. So friends, are you searching? Are you asking that great plaguing question about suffering in the world? Why? I can't promise you an answer, at least not easy answers, maybe not full answers, or an answer that you might want. But I can tell you this. You will only ever begin to find an answer to that question in God. And in the end, as we'll see, the point isn't so much that we find an answer, but we find the one who is the answer. In God alone shall we find any rest, any comfort, any peace. It is God alone who is our advocate. We sing a song here at RBC called "Jesus is Lord" by Stuart Townend. The second verse goes like this: Jesus is Lord, whose voice sustains the stars and planets, yet in wisdom laid aside his crown. Jesus, the man who washed our feet, who bore our suffering, became a curse to bring salvation's plan. So if you're searching for answers, pray that you would turn your gaze to the one who sees all, to the one who knows all, who suffered all, to the one whose voice sustains the stars and planets, to the one whose voice tells the rain when to fall and the lightning where to go, who sends the wind and tells the proud waves when they must stay. And yet, in wisdom, he laid aside his crown. And through what he suffered, he brought salvation's plan home to people like us, fools like us, people who have no hope of obtaining a sliver of the wisdom of the universe. But the Apostle Paul tells us that Christ has become for us the wisdom of God. So do you want to be wise? Do you want to know wisdom's place? Look to Jesus Christ.